Welcome to Common Ground YYC on Livewire Calgary.
Reviendra à la ville de Calgary. Calgary!
Today, Calgary is a different place than it was yesterday.
Right, welcome to episode 7 of Common Ground. This is our first attempt at a roundtable format discussion, so bear with us as we try and experiment with this format. Today we're going to focus on development and the planning and development of the City of Calgary, focusing on a few key issues around how we grow, specifically how we grow, how we fund it, how we go about actually achieving some of the civic goals of the city. So I have four gentlemen with me from a variety of backgrounds and a variety of perspectives on the issue. So maybe just introduce yourself to the group and a little bit about what you do.
Cool. Thanks for having me on, Josh. My name is Alkarim Divani. I'm one of the co-founders here at Round Square, and we are an established neighborhoods inner city developer doing everything from ground oriented to mixed use multifamily.
Hi, I'm Peter Shrivers, and I'm an urban planner, and I've had experience in both the public and private sectors. And planners, we really look at how projects get approved and consulting with communities through that process.
One of the nerdiest planners I know.
Nerd.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Bob Van Wiegen. First of all, I'd like to point out that this is, in fact, a rectangular round table. So you can visualize in your mind, dear listener.
We are in round square offices. I don't know why we can't find a round table.
This is the square portion of the round office, yes. I'm the executive director of the Marteloup Business Improvement Area, but I also have a background in urban planning, and I've worked for the Federation of Calgary Communities and also on heritage issues.
And I'm Joel Tiedemann. I'm a development manager with Anthem Properties. We work primarily on established areas, mixed use, and multifamily developments, but we also have an arm that looks after suburban development as well.
All right. And I'm, as you know, Josh White, the host of the Common Ground YYC podcast, but I am also a developer and a planner by profession with Dream Development. And we do, in this market, primarily greenfield development, but we are looking at acquisitions in the urban, fairly large scale realm too. So I'm excited to have this group. We have a good variety of perspectives, public and private sector, in the community side. We have large scale development, smaller scale development, and both urban and suburban context. So, you know, this is really the crux of a lot of the conversation that's been happening in Calgary's, but that urban suburban split, and going back all the way to the municipal development plan developed in 2009, we're almost 10 years in to the MDP. Sort of mixed results, I think we could agree in terms of achieving some of those goals. We've had periods of growth where in hotter times we're reaching much closer to those targets. But Peter, maybe, you know, you're pretty well versed in MDP. Give us a little bit of a background about what the MDP actually says in terms of what we want to do.
Definitely a good way to start. The MDP really is kind of like the highest level of plan in the City of Calgary, and it has a lot of really broad goals. I think two of the bigger ones is just what share of growth the MDP is trying to achieve in the City of Calgary. And so we can have these very long-term goals. One of them is to accommodate 50% of growth in what we call the established areas by 2076. So that's a really long-term goal. That's like 60 years out. And that's from, I think, from 2006. And then we have a goal to achieve 33% or a third by 2039. So that's a little bit shorter term of a goal. And so we're really looking at how to balance growth in the City of Calgary.
Yeah, and one of the issues I've seen with the MDP is people don't quite understand what those goals actually entail. Those are actually meant to be cumulative goals, even though I think some planners, both in the private and public sector and in the development industry, think those are more kind of point in time.
Yeah, that's correct. So it is a cumulative goal. So like very roughly by 2076, we estimate that Calgary is going to be about 2 and a bit million, and we're going to grow by about 1.2 million. And so just think of it that way. Think about 600 and let's say 50,000 people in both the greenfields and in the established areas by 2076. And that's kind of like the very large kind of scale growth pattern we want to see.
So what we've seen, I think, over the last almost 10 years into implementation, you know, the MDP was implemented right at the time the global economy kind of went off a cliff. And so it was a difficult time for the city in terms of in-migration, these sorts of things. And we didn't see a lot of that take up in the established area early on. And part of that was just the demographics of who was moving into the city, the job situation, the economy. And then we actually hit a period of, you know, relative success, I would say, in terms of meeting those goals. So I was looking at some of the data, 2012 to 2014. So in the 10-year span, it's been a little crazy. We started off with a global recession that hit us. Then we went through a period of hot economic times in Calgary. And now we're back into a period of slower growth in the city. And a lot of the demographic factors are showing that, you know, we have less in-migration interprovincially, you know, less younger people moving in. How much do we need to pay attention to those macro factors when we're talking about goals of the MDP? You know, there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, it looked like in 2012 to 2014, we were very close to hitting those interim targets. We're, you know, upwards of 33% of that growth happening in established communities. More than 40% of new dwelling units were happening. But that's fallen off again in recent years. And then over the 10-year span, we've had about 12% of that growth in the first 10 years of the 60-year plan. So how do we think about those types of factors in the achievement of the MDP?
Yeah, I think one thing to point out, you pointed out there, is the kind of 12% growth in the established areas. And what's important to kind of understand is the different kind of sub-sectors in there and just the demographics. So for instance, last year, I think it was something like 12% of growth happened in our established areas. But actually our center city and inner city accounted for 30% of the growth. That seems kind of weird. That's because our kind of suburbs, our outlying suburbs like 70s and 80s that were started around there, they lost cumulatively 18% of the growth of the city, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so you're right. What we see is our center city and our inner cities are actually kind of growing quite well. And what's happening is that we're seeing demographic losses in other areas. And that's just really a matter of, you know, kids are moving out and families are getting smaller in those areas. And so we're seeing that loss there. And so there's a lot of dynamics that are at that play here. And so when we do see high periods of kind of interprovincial growth, you know, people moving from Ontario and stuff, that's where we see lots of growth in our inner city, because a lot of people in that kind of demographic are moving to those areas. But when we see lower growth from outside, that's when that kind of tails off and we see more of the losses from kind of outer areas kind of really affect that kind of net growth.
So I want to talk to a couple of the developers in the room here too. One, you know, Joel, you guys are primarily looking at fairly large scale development. You guys develop a lot of apartment style rentals and condominium type units. And Al, you guys have worked on a lot of more ground oriented stuff, maybe more larger units, townhouses. This is sort of how you carved out your niche in the marketplace. How have you seen those ebbs and flows in the market affect the types of buyers you have, the types of volumes you have?
Yeah.
Good times and bad.
So I think, like, when we talk about the MDP and we talk about the relative growth of the inner cities and our city center, the fabric of that housing that's being provided is really interesting. And I think Ian Meredith from Dreams, I had an opportunity to sit with him on a panel and he kind of nailed it on the head, that the biggest missing piece for us right now is that family-orientated dwelling. And so there's only so much market demand for that condo, multifamily housing. And I think that kind of changes with market, but I also think that changes with, you know, interest rates and policy from a federal level perspective. So I think with this new kind of turn in economics, we're seeing a lot of developers move to purpose-built rental. And I think it's because it's more accessible at this time, which I also think is good because it will help us get closer to those targets. And so getting back to my point about the ground orientation, it's kind of where we saw the biggest void in the marketplace. And so the challenge that we tasked ourselves with is how do we actually get families to consider like raising their families in the inner city rather than going to the suburbs and finding a way to do it affordably. And I think the best way for us to do that is not through product per se, but it's through education and through really helping people understand what these inner city communities have to offer and what it's like to live in an established neighborhood and what are the benefits. We talked about commuting and, you know, are you okay with a 45-minute commute or would you rather have a 10-minute commute? Are you okay riding public transit? Are you used to alternative modes of transportation? And so for us as a developer, I almost see ourselves as like stewards of education in urban living, because I think once a family can kind of get here and start to use the existing amenities and infrastructure, it's where we're going to see the most amount of success, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Joel?
And I think for us, even going back to Al's point about what's really missing in the market right now, I mean, Anthem is a Vancouver-based developer and you can't build enough fast enough for the market there. So I think during the time before the global recession, when Anthem first dipped their toe into the Calgary market, we were looking at things like the big development that we have in Eau Claire waterfront. You know, it's 1,000 units, it's 10 buildings. It's the scale is huge. And we're now curtailing that vision a little bit. We're very, very bullish on Calgary. We like that the market is, while it's low right now, it's a lot more predictable than than other markets like in Vancouver or Toronto. And so what we're looking at now is how do we fill that middle? So we have some projects in Kensington that are, you know, 5-story wood frame, you know, a lot more urban scale rather than, you know, concrete towers. And the other thing that we're seeing in the market right now is it's just really difficult unless you're going the rental route to actually pencil the numbers for concrete builds. So we're starting to look at 40 to 90 unit townhome sites because there's a huge demand for it. We obviously can't, with our scale, we can't do, you know, corner lot RCGs, which I would love to do more of. But we're doing, you know, we're moving towards that ground orientation because there's a demand for it in the established areas. And I think it's the future of development in the city.
Bob, so Bob, you're executive director of Marta Loop. So you're sort of the epicenter of redevelopment movements and accommodating a whole bunch of different forms. As a BIA, a business improvement mm-hmm. area, what are you guys doing to, you know, to touch a little bit on Al's point, to sort of market or talk about that urban living lifestyle as being attractive? Certainly there's a role to play in communities and BIAs in enabling and encouraging this type of development. How do you see that challenge?
Well, for Marta Loop, Marta Loop has had obviously a tremendous amount of change. Marta Loop is sort of, it's in a weird spot in Calgary. We're kind of like a little spot of urbanism in the middle of the suburban southwest, or we're on the urban suburban cusp. We're not
right. We're
not adjacent to the core, but we're also not on the other side of Crowchow Trail, and it's for the businesses. You know, we've had a lot of new commercial come on, but what we need in our area is more people living nearby. A lot of our merchants depend on the neighborhood, and the neighborhood depends on our merchants as well. So we've been very supportive of new residential development in the area, but it's been a change. We're not yet the really nice, walkable, cool urban place we're trying to be, but we're certainly not the suburban bungalows and small strip malls that we were maybe even only 8 years ago. We're in this place where what's really missing, I feel, in our area is the reinvestment in the public realm. We've had, if you go through our area, you'll be challenged with all the construction happening, whether you're walking or driving, and you'll see how much growth there's been. But I think the thing that will make an area of ours even more attractive for businesses and for residences and more successful is to get those public realm improvements that we should be getting with the amount of change and the amount of increase in economic activity and taxes that are being generated in places like Marda-Loup.
I want to get a bit back to the bigger question of the MDP, and a lot of the rhetoric around the MDP is related to the urban-suburban split. You know, there's certainly goals in the MDP to talk about increasing that urban market share, you know, moving towards more of a 50% thing. But, you know, a lot of things I hear, and maybe I'm just sensitive to it because I'm a suburban developer currently trying to do interesting things in the suburban context. But there's a lot of talk about, well, you know, really the only way we're going to ever get there is we really just need to put a stop to suburban development. You know, as developers and as planners, you know, how, you know, looking at the marketplace in Calgary, how realistic you think that idea is in terms of stopping or radically shifting the market share of urban to suburban in this context. So, you know, I'm thinking about just the sheer scale of development and people and housing units that are produced in the market. You know, what would that look like in terms of trying to shift that so radically in this marketplace? How realistic is it given, you know, affordability thresholds and these sorts of questions? How do you think about that, Peter?
No, definitely a good question. And I think, first of all, there is this kind of false dichotomy about suburban and urban. And a lot of that discussion is tainted with this kind of value judgment about, you know, if you're a suburbanite, you think, oh, those urbanites, they're all just hipsters that drink lattes and they're terrible people.
As you're
drinking a latte.
I will point out, I live in latte sipping land in their city.
And then, you know, and I bet you, you know, some urbanites might say, oh, they're suburbanites, they just drive cars everywhere and they hate the environment. But that's not true. Everyone chooses to live where they want to live for a whole variety of reasons.
And office is just a rational decision based on economics.
You know, based on where you work and all those kind of things. But that's the scale of change, I think, is important for people to grasp. If we were to just say no more suburbs in Calgary today, you know, we're looking at, we grow by about 20,000 people-ish per year.
About 7,000 housing units a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you got to think about what that scale of change would look like for neighborhoods. Another thing you have to think about is if we didn't allow suburbs to be built, what would happen to that market? Would it go to areas outside of Calgary?
We don't operate in a vacuum, right?
Exactly. So there is a balance there, right? And I think, you know, the reason why council passed the municipal development plan those years ago wasn't a value judgment. It was economics and financing. It was looking at, you know, if you grow out and only grow out, you have to deal with more sewers and more roads and more transit. Than if you grow in. So they really looked at a balance and they looked at that over a long period of time. And so it really is this, I think the balance, and I think most people kind of fit in that middle. They're not, you know, partisans in terms of being extreme suburbanites or extreme urbanites. Yeah. A lot of people in the middle, and they just want to live in an affordable place that's convenient for them and is good for their particular, you know, if they have kids or if they don't have kids, they're trying to match their lifestyle. And so it's really our challenge is to try to provide that choice.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of the conversation coming out of the MDP was, you know, making sure that you have more or less an even playing field in terms of, you know, allocating the true cost of that growth. And a lot of the work that has been done in terms of suburban levies and things like that has been trying to move towards a world where you're trying to make decisions about growth with eyes wide open in terms of what the true costs of that, both in terms of the capital and operating, and making sure we're growing in a way that becomes more financially sustainable to the city. That's really what it's about you know, with an eye towards shifting that market share over time helps in that case. But, you know, Al, you've been very critical of some suburban development. In your eyes, are the suburbs redeemable? Can you do it in a way that makes the city financially sustainable, that it helps pay for itself, it has forms that are more conducive to, you know, some of the things we like about urban communities in Calgary? Isn't that the goal of the MDP?
Yeah, I'd have to say, like, I've learned a considerable amount in the last 2 years, and it's from a number of different perspectives. I feel like there's a business case, there's a political case, there's a sustainability case. And so when I put on all the hats, you know, from a pure business case as a strictly established inner city developer, the more new communities and offerings that we offer, we as the inner city, you know, established neighborhoods selling units, I don't think we'll ever catch them. We'll never be able to provide the sheer affordability that, you know, the suburb provide. There's just a gap there that we will never be able to touch. And so when I wear my business hat, it's always challenging to say, how do we convince families to stay in the established hoods when we can't find ways to compete on price? And obviously, price is king when markets are down. And so that's from a pure business perspective, I think it's always difficult for us. And that's kind of when I engage, you know, administration and council to say, we need better ways to compete with, you know, new growth. And the way that I think better ways happen are through things like tax incentives, or can we actually pour a bunch of money into neighborhoods to provide more affordable options? So you look at, like, you know, areas like Albert Park or International Avenue or Ogden or Montgomery that are begging for some sort of redevelopment. And so I don't know why we're not at a place where if these targets are real and we want to start seeing them and we know what we're missing in terms of the fabric, the city needs to come to the table and say, okay, here's what we'll do to incentivize that. And so as our firm starts to grow and we're now looking to work in Winnipeg, like, I know when I first went down to Winnipeg, they had like a 5-year tax freeze for center city growth and trying to bring developers to say, come in and develop here, and here's the advantage to doing that. And so I think that's something I think we need to see happen. I would say, though, like, from a political perspective, is it 11 of our councillors represent the suburbs? You know, I don't know what the actual population percentage is that represents suburban living, but I know it's obviously a vast majority. I grew up in a suburb. I actually never came down to the established communities. I think I made a comment about how my first time at an arena was when I was 15 years old. And so our family didn't come into the downtown because we had no reason to. Like, our community was built within the suburbs. And so I don't have like a hate for the suburbs, but what I would say I do have is like this newfound love for the established communities, and I want to figure out a way to make that more inclusive for people. And so I just think that we are going to have to get creative as industry, as city, as public, to figure out ways to really have that balanced growth. And I would say, talking to even Josh and seeing what you guys are doing in Providence and seeing what Truman is doing in West District, it's actually phenomenal. Like, it's exciting to see that we're building these new communities. And, like, you know, for the first time, I want to, like, make the commute out to go see what it looks like and be like, oh man, how cool is this? Like, they have rapid transit bus routes and they have this crazy amenity space and they're like, you know, Jamin Village, I've never been there and I keep hearing about it, but I heard Mahogany's like pulling in all these cool businesses. So I'm like, there's something to be said there. And I know that we need to create affordable options for our city and for our residents. And so that, to me, is really what I think the suburbs and new community growth serves, is it's an opportunity for more families to join our city. And even if they're stepping stones, but what my goal is, and I think what we need to work to, is like, how do we create more affordable options in our established neighborhoods?
Yeah. Joel?
So I think
do you hate suburbs?
I think I get a bit of a unique perspective because while most of the projects that I work on are in the established areas, I can walk down the hall and talk to my colleagues at Anthem United who work on strictly suburban projects. So it's interesting to see, why are the sales absorptions X on my inner city projects while the absorptions on our suburban land, why? And you can really see, going back to what Al said, it's the value proposition and the affordability. I think it would take a monumental shift in the mindset of how people live in Alberta. It's not even just Calgary. You see the same thing in Edmonton. You see the same thing in Winnipeg, where we don't have land constraints. A family with two kids who has two vehicles who wants a yard can go out into the suburbs and buy a 2,000 square foot house for $400,000. What does that get you in the established areas? So I think people, while I think everyone sitting around this table, we could point out to a handful of people who we know who would raise kids in the established areas, that is not the predominant mindset. And until we have that shift, we're going to need to smartly balance how we grow both in the suburban and the urban areas.
Yeah, it's Bob here. I'm just, it's interesting what you say. I know for a long time, different groups, even groups like Sustainable Calgary, used to try and convince people to think about, when you're living inner city, think about your total cost of living in your inner city,
right?
The cost of your commute. Maybe you don't need those two cars, maybe you lose cars. So it's the price of, you know, the price of per square foot of your house in the suburbs is less than living in the inner city, but you can also live in the inner city with a lot fewer transportation costs and shorter commutes, more time on your hands. But like people are saying, I don't know if people get that or they care about that. They may care more about having two vehicles than they care about those other things. And so I think it's a bit of a challenge. It'd be interesting to have a little focus group of people who are who have made those two different choices. I'm in a high density building in Mission, an older one with large units. And we have about three or four families living in there out of about 140 units, which isn't a lot, but they're raising their families in there. And you know, it's a great building. We've got an upper deck with a big green space so you can go out and run around. There's a pool. And it's a short walk to Rideau Park School. You have your choice of elementary schools, actually. It's so you got a backyard, you got a pool, you got to walk to school, you're right across the street from the Safeway. Why aren't more families doing that?
Yeah, one observation I've made in just thinking about how we're going about developing a new suburban community is, you know, if you look at kind of three major factors, affordability, you know, the family friendliness of units. So enough, for example, three bedroom type units where you can, where more people would be able to make a choice about in terms of living. And then walkability. We've been really good at each community achieving two of those three things. So if you think about, you know, the downtown core, it's both quite affordable, you know, the center city, it's extremely walkable and amenity laden. But there's just not a lot of units that can accommodate families with children. If you think about the opposite end of the spectrum, the suburbs, you know, the prototypical suburb, it's been affordable, relatively speaking. It's had a lot of family-friendly units, but has lacked that amenity and walkable community. And then you have kind of the inner ring of the city, place where I live, you know, community, if you look like Hillhurst or Kensington, where it's both very walkable and it's got a lot of family-friendly units, but it's also extraordinarily expensive. Not a lot of people in the city can afford to live in these areas. So how do you actually create more communities, both in the suburbs and in the established areas, that you can get all three? I think this price differential is one of the things that are just going to continue to drive the market demand. And on one hand, it's a great thing that our inner city is so attractive that it's so expensive. But it also just, by virtue of that, just prices out a certain number of people in the marketplace. So do we have to just accept that there's going to be an upset limit in terms of the sheer numbers of people that we can accommodate in those established areas, and then focus on making that better, more affordable in the ways that we can, and then just knowing that a certain percentage are just going to live in the suburbs, and just making sure that those areas are developed better, more sustainably. I think that's ultimately what the MDP is about. Mm-hmm. What do you guys make of that notion?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, Josh, especially going back to what I said earlier about Calgary not having land constraints. So even if you were to shut off suburban development completely, we have so many outlying communities like Chestermere, Okotoks, Airdrie. People would just, that suburban buyer would just go buy the same product somewhere else, which isn't a good outcome for the city.
Right.
So I think even like with what Dream is doing at Providence or whatever you guys are going to call it, or if you look at
Still start searching for a name if you have any suggestions.
Or what Brookfield is doing in Seton, where you're creating an urban hub. So, you know, back to Al's point, you're maybe not having that 45-minute commute. If you can have all your amenities, all your shopping, your everything that you need, your community hubs, and rather than having to drive people who live in the suburbs into the core, we can have these little pockets of like culture and density throughout the city.
Yeah. So I want to touch on this based on like get back to the question of the MDP about how we, I know Peter, you've done a little bit of analysis of, you know, I think one of the issues with the MDP is it just talks about the established community writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a monolith. There's a lot of gradations of density and age and form. And, you know, has one of the stumbling blocks been in achieving some of our goals, you know, matching our implementation strategies to the realities of each of those sort of concentric rings in our city, rather than just thinking of them generically as established areas? Because mm-hmm. as you mentioned off the top, there's established areas in the city developed in, you know, the 80s that are losing population. Mm-hmm. We're expecting, you know, the areas where Joel and Al developed to make up that ground.
Yeah.
Even if we just thought about our goals differently, wouldn't that make us think about what we needed to do differently to achieve them? So now let's really get into the weeds of how we actually go about improving that ratio mm-hmm. of redevelopment in the established areas.
Yeah. So that's a really excellent question. The way I see it right now is that Calgary's been very successful on kind of two ends of the redevelopment spectrum.
Right.
One is the downtown, especially Beltline. Beltline's actually the fastest growing inner city community. And last year was the fastest growing community in Calgary. It grew by 1,700.
Martaloop's not bad.
Yeah, Martaloop's not bad. So, but Beltline, well, Center City has grown on average. I think Beltline's grown on average by 650 people per year for the last 10 years. So it's phenomenal. It's got like 6 or 7 towers under construction at any one time. And the reason for that is because it's got very permissive mm-hmm. policy.
Right.
It basically, you know, the policy is basically build things here, build big towers, do lots of things. We want development.
Yeah. I was a planner for them in the early days. As were you.
As was I. The mm-hmm. other end of the spectrum is in kind of the early 2010s, or I think late, maybe 2009, the city did something called contextual rules for infills. And so this changed kind of the development of semi-detached dwellings or duplexes in the inner city to make it easier for developers to do it. So if you just met a certain amount of rules, you got your permit and there was no appeals. And that really put out, you know, spurred this huge development of that. And so there's all kinds of custom builders that were going out and building these things. And so you have this, we have this dichotomy. So we have really good downtown tower growth and we have good growth in infills, but infills are very expensive and towers aren't for everybody. What we're missing is what Al talked about, that kind of missing middle, that ground oriented stuff, the wood frame stuff. But I also think one of the things that we don't think about enough is the areas just outside our inner city and what can happen with them. These are like the Brentwoods and the Thorn Cliffs and like the Glen Morgans and things like that. Those areas, I think, are actually, you know, good areas for very low scale growth, just semi-detached dwellings, just really small stuff, but just get the ball rolling because a lot of those areas are losing population. Secondary suites help as well. So there's, I think we got to think of it. A lot of people in their minds, they think, densification needs towers everywhere. That's not the case. There's all kinds of forms of growth and you're going to see different types in different areas. And we got to just start thinking about how does every community accommodate its growth that it has to do.
So just to, before you jump in, Al, just like on the targets, like mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier, like the downtown, the center city. So that's mm-hmm. the downtown, East Village, Beltline, et cetera, you know, achieved about 10,000 growth in the last 10-year period. The first ring around it achieved about, I think it was about 13,000, like pretty healthy growth actually in that period through, you know, one up cycle and two down cycles in that 10-year period. But the further you got out, the, you know, where you started to either go flat or go down in population, should we actually even just change the targets in the MDP to think about, you know, we grew 10,000 in the center city in the last 10 year period. Let's try and get to 15,000 in the next 10 year period. And then actually just really focus on the things you need to do to get there rather than just start worrying about the established area as a whole or the urban suburban split is so much of a focus of the thinking around policy.
And that might be a way to kind of, yeah, rethink about it is that some areas, you know, these 80s and 90s suburbs, I think the goal is just to stop losing population.
Right.
And maybe we should split it up to say, here's our center city, you know, goal, here's our inner city goal, here's the next kind of ring out. And then other ones, yeah, it's just, how do we not lose population here? And then that might be a better way to frame it. Because in a way,
because that would make you think about how to do that very specifically, as opposed to just like, the established areas is what do we need to do
and,
overall?
And right? In some ways, the inner city and center city are being punished, you know, quote unquote punished for these other areas losing population so quickly that it doesn't look like we're doing these things, but we are. Like, we're growing quite significantly. It's just that, you know, these 80s, 90s suburbs are losing people so rapidly that can't make up for it.
So Al, Peter talked, you touched on that quote unquote missing middle problem. And this sort of speaks to the housing preference issue and how we think more granularly about where and how people want to live. Because as Peter said, you know,
common ground,
it's very easy to build a high rise in Calgary in a lot of different locations. We don't lack for supply of places and enabling policy or even reinvestment. A lot of reinvestment in the Bell Line over the last 10 years to try and induce that type of demand. But, you know, a lot of that depends on demographic cycles and things like that, where, you know, the amount of demand you get for apartment is very elastic with the economy. The more stable kind of change can happen, I think, in that more family oriented thing. And I think that's where a lot of the growth will need to come from in that established area. Now, you know, some of the product you're building is still going to be more expensive, you know, just by virtue of land costs and development costs for a like and similar product in a new community. Mm-hmm. How can we become more competitive in the established area for that missing middle product?
Yeah, so this is obviously one of the biggest challenges I think we as an organization and as a city face. And I think we as a particular organization that's very, very like focused on ground orientation, missing middle in Calgary is like, there isn't that many of us. Like, you know, Joel and Anthem has said how they've started to look at this now, but sometimes I feel like we're the only people at the table. And so when you talk about advocacy or you talk about groups that are aligned and how do we actually stress the urgency of this type of fabric in our established communities, it's quite difficult even when we talk in respect to cost. And that's when I look to the city to say, okay, well, do we need to be able to, you know, the stormwater retention plan, like as soon as you go over 2 units and you have 3 units, we need infrastructure to catch stormwater retention for a 100-year flood. And so you think about
this. It's just not tenable.
It's the sheer cost of us to put in like 7 tanks on a 50-foot lot to capture a flood in 100 years just makes no sense. So how do we get to those targets when there is no benefit to providing the fabric is why I'm struggling. So, okay, yeah, you know what? We're pushing so hard to get these things. We're driving the prices down as much as we possibly can. And we're like getting near 600,000. But the city could come in and say, okay, you know what? If you're ground oriented development, we're gonna remove the offsite levy costs, or we're gonna change the stormwater catchment requirements, or we're gonna do something to incentivize a fabric. And I think that to me is super key. And even Josh, you touched on affordability in our established communities. Like, naturally, you know, it's not a bad thing if our inner cities, and in most market we look at it, become expensive, because that means that we are growing and there is this economic vibrancy to it. Mm-hmm. But what I would like to see then is, okay, well, you know, everyone right now is really nervous and concerned about the center city levies of the world, the BCEF fund, you know, the money that developers are being asked to contribute. And so I feel like I would rather you know, put in an X amount of affordable housing units, attainable housing units, so we create diversity in our established communities, rather than writing a check for who knows what. And I think that's the biggest concern, is like, where is that money going when we cut those checks? And why can't we use that money to better improve our own urban realm, or better improve the fabric of people living in our buildings? And so I think really this is a conversation of innovation and planning. And, you know, I'm not a planner, so I don't have all the answers. I'm a keen listener, and I like to watch and learn. And so I do believe there is some metrics that can be put in place. So, you know, in 20 years, we're not Vancouver, and you can't afford to live anywhere in our inner city community. And like, home ownership is a luxury. It's like unattainable. Like, we need to start thinking about these things soon, because I do believe Calgary will get there. It is an exciting city. There is lots on the go. I don't think we don't feel like we're anywhere near doom and gloom. We're still super stoked to really call this home. So,
okay, I think we're getting to the crux of the matter now, which is, you know, not just the rhetoric and the talk about what the goals we want to achieve are, but really how we do it. The easy part's writing a plan that says achieve X percentage in your established area. 99% of the work is the hard work on the investment and the policy and the enabling elements of making it happen in your marketplace. So, Joel, I know one of the big things you've been on about a lot, I think rightly, is the funding mechanisms to make the infrastructure costs more equitable, more predictable, to reduce those barriers, lower those costs, incentivize development, or put the right structures in place that at minimum give you the type of certainty you need to make those types of investments. We've sort of facetiously, you know, hashtagged it, you know, out of the Olympics conversation, pipes 2026. You know, these are the boring conversations about the things that are happening in the market that are stumbling blocks to redevelopment. So talk a little bit about hashtag pipes 2026.
Sure. So I'm gonna
what's the problem you're getting at here?
So I'm gonna come back to that in a bit of a circuitous route. But so if you look again at the affordability gap between suburban and urban, just, I know there's a dichotomy there, but I'm gonna use it for simplicity's sake. If I, as a developer, of housing, not land, so important distinction there, make an application in a suburban community, I have my land use in place, I submit for a development permit, I submit for a building permit, I go ahead and build. Everything is in place, there's no additional costs, it's pretty cut and dry, you know exactly what you're getting. When you're looking at an established areas project, you have a series of levies that you need to pay, you have to go through your land use application, you have your community engagement, which is a very important piece, but takes time. You have the uncertainty around, can the existing infrastructure, and I'm talking about underground infrastructure, so not exciting stuff like Green Line and roads and bridges, I'm talking about pipes. So hence sewer, hashtag pipes 2026, yeah. Sewer, water, electrical, gas, all that kind of stuff. And when you do an established areas project and you have to pay potentially to upgrade city-owned infrastructure like that, that cost all gets downloaded on the end product. So you have all these other inputs in established area development that you don't have in suburban development that just help to, or I guess not help, but they hinder that affordability issue. So I think what we need to really look at, because what we see time and time again, sometimes it's first in, sometimes it's last in, but when you go over the capacity of the existing city infrastructure, that cost gets downloaded on the developer. And rightly or wrongly, that developer ends up having to cover that cost or abandoning the project. So I think what we need to look at is, how can we fund growth in the inner city from an infrastructure perspective? So how can we ensure that the developments that get put forward, like you said, Josh, have some certainty in terms of what costs are going to run into as we go? And I don't think we can continue to look at it on a one-off basis, project by project. We need a more wholesome program of how we actually grow in our inner city.
Yeah, and Al, I know you've talked about, you know, the dichotomy in terms of even the amount of attention and resources that have gone into, you know, those costs do exist in the suburban development. You got to extend pipes, you got to run roads, you got to build interchanges, you have to do all these things, but they're has always or has long been and it's become more robust, a pretty systematic way of paying for those development costs through levies and other mechanisms. The problem seems to have been on the established areas that, you know, first there was maybe a perception that we had, you know, unlimited capacity to achieve this density. I think we've learned very clearly that's not true. It's just that whenever it gets to get paid for by the developer, it's just on an ad hoc, one-off basis. There's not a very good understanding of the capacities that exist. So what do you think the solution is? Is it, you know, I know in the center city, you have, you know, the city typically front ends and they recoup through a frontage levy. And maybe there's an argument to be made whether the frontage levy is a fair type of levy, but it does create some predictability. The developer's never on the hook for a $10 million sanitary upgrade that he triggers with a, you know, a 60 unit building or something. But that happens all over the established areas elsewhere. So how do you create, is it a catchment system? Is it a development reserve that the city carries to front end that infrastructure and then is recouped through, you know, some sort of equitable levy system? That's not going to kill the economics of a building. And, you know, you have tax up, there's a lot of tax uplift that comes with new or redevelopment in the established areas. What's the right systematic approach to attacking that problem? It's just so fundamental to achieving our growth goals. It has to start with even just understanding the capacities that we have.
Yeah. The best way I think about doing this, it's like an insurance model. You know, everybody here that's developing is dealing with risk and a risk of a cost that is unknown. And when you have something like that, what you need to do is spread that risk out so that everyone is contributing equally and it's not random, you know. And so just think of it, the way I try to think of it is, if I was an insurance company and I was selling insurance to developers of, this is your stormwater upgrade insurance, what price would I charge? And I think that's really what you need to kind of think of it as. There's a lot that needs to go into that because you have to start to look at, you know, what are those capacities, and that, you know, that requires, you know, civil engineers to do studies and things like that. But really what you should look at is to say, you know, what is our capacity now? What is a reasonable kind of increase to that capacity, we think, in terms of our growth targets? And then just spread that cost out for everybody.
Right.
And as the insurer, you're always, you have to do that because you got to spread that out. So you just have to spread that risk out. Sometimes, you know, you might think you're taking on that risk, but you're not, because everyone has to pay even if there's not an upgrade triggered at that moment, because you are still using that capacity. So it's just a way that I think a systematic approach and an equal approach and an approach that's based on the size of your project. Because one of the problems, like Joel pointed out, you could have a 12 unit building and then you get, you know, hit for an upgrade that's, you know, $5 million. And you're like, well, that's my entire project cost. I can't sell anything.
So how do you avoid the problem, though? I mean, there's a cost to it, right? Mm-hmm. And how is that fairly allocated? I mean, I'd argue that, you know, a lot of this stuff is, in a sense, almost like a pure life cycle cost. Like, does the general ratepayer, the general taxpayer, take on more of the responsibility from the developer? Because the thing I worry about it is, if you allocate these costs, suddenly it makes projects less affordable, not more.
And there's a balance between how much we require developers to pay of that, but also how much we recognize that that development is going to increase the tax base.
Yeah.
It's going to increase the
assessed value. There's a public good to it.
So you almost have to amortize not just the cost right up front, but amortize what that tax increase is and recognize that that, you know, that tax increase is going to pay for that capital over time. And so that has to be kind of baked in. So I don't know exactly what that is. I'm not an actuary or a civil engineer, but
Al, you want to jump in?
Neither am I, but this is actually what I find super fascinating. So Councillor DeMong had said that when they were having the budget talks regarding the main streets, as he said, there's no business case in front of me to show me, to make me understand that this investment actually then provides, you know, an X dollar on return. But the thing about the main streets that is so dynamic is there is that kind of unidentifiable return on investment. And so when we talk about how many different levels of investment are we getting, some of it you can't necessarily define. And that's what I think is challenging. But the uplift is the most logical and simple explanation. And, you know, you take, I think the Kensington Legic project project always comes to mind, like a current $15,000 a year tax base that will be generating $1 million annually. So like a 1,000-time increase as soon as that project is built and developed and realized. And so when we talk about, well, where does the capital come from? You know, what happens in this for the city who has to come in and, you know, try to provide some sort of funding or investment? It's quite obvious that that money is there. And, you know, when we get into the weeds of tax capturing, it's like, yes, yeah, some of this benefit needs to come back above and below grade.
Yeah.
And I think the city can easily identify what the revenue generation for these are.
Yeah.
And so when they look at, okay, well, should I invest X of dollars so that X developer can return capital of X year over year over year? To me, the business case is so obvious.
Yeah. And let's get into that conversation about Main Street, some of the sexier above ground stuff, because this did come up in council. And as you talked about, you know, council did, the ask was made. I think Councillor Carroll had a really thoughtful motion to try and advance the idea of investing in Main Street as a key component of the established area strategy. Now, where as you talked about, where I think where council was left wanting a bit was, it seemed like a lot of this work should have been going on over the last 3 years to really clearly define
exactly
what the upside is.
Because like,
even though it might be self-evident to us, it has to be spelled out in a way that is politically salable. Now, luckily, at least they understood the importance and are moving it forward to get to that answer. It's just frustrating that it hasn't happened to date. Bob, you're at the center of one of the areas that are, you know, eligible for some of that funding that was allocated, that will hopefully be allocated more of in the longer term in the Marta Loop area, because, you know, there's a fairly self-evident business case. There's a lot of private investment already, all these sorts of things. How do you spell out that case to make those types of investments and get the political buy-in to make it happen?
You know, it's amazing that didn't happen before. The city has approved the Main Streets program. They approved an implementation plan just a couple of years ago. They had a whole list of Main Streets with a bunch of very aggressive dates on it. And then it comes to the four-year budget and there's actually $0 in it to do any of that implementation. That was just unbelievable to me that so much work that had gone into this, which is, you know, a part that's really, it was really a big part of implementing the MDP. We'd get to a four-year budget cycle without that having been worked out. And I think, as people have said, is that there is a pretty obvious business case for it, even if, you know, from that's been laid out here quite well. And I think that in the next very, very short period of time, just in the next few months, following up on the established communities framework that they're going to be working on, plus the stuff that got passed at council, thanks to Councillor Kara's motion, I think that the city and advocates for things to happen on Main Streets have got to pull those pieces together and put them forward in an understandable way. I think the information's actually lying around fairly simply.
Yeah, you know, from my observation, to me, it's not that there hasn't been a lot of dollars that have flowed into the established communities. There's just been a lot of parks, tons of parks reinvestments, streets, transit. You know, all the MAX lines are touching on established communities, will have big, meaningful impacts on growth in those areas. The Green Line is, at least stage one, is exclusively touching on established areas. I think what's missing, though, is sort of the strategic alignment. And the Main Streets program really highlights that. If those are strategic places of growth in our city, we need sort of strategic alignment of funding mechanisms and resources to go into that to more explicitly reach our goals in terms of growth specifically. Like, you have these things happening, but they're not happening, they're happening kind of on an ad hoc basis rather than a strategic basis.
Al? Yeah, if I can jump in. Yeah, I think like we have 24 identified main streets. And I think Councilor Frella said there's so many that are on here that kind of meet the requirement of main streets. Like when are we going to include those? And I think from my perspective, we need to do one. Like we need to do one main street. We need to fund it. We need to complete it. And then we need to go back and say, this worked, this didn't work, let's fix this. And now we have a policy that funded and we have community certainty and all the stakeholders can say, okay, this is what I liked about this one. This is what I thought was terrible about this. And to me, it's like, hey, we have $30 million, but we have 24 main streets. And so it's like, honestly, like I know McLeod Trail is on there like a main. I don't care about McLeod Trail right now. Like I really don't.
I think we use the words lost cause.
Yeah, and so
cities need ugly areas too.
Yeah, and so like, and not to say that it doesn't deserve some love and attention at some point, but we need strategic action and planning. Yeah. And in order to do that, we need to identify, you know, here's a successful main street and let's stop making all these communities doing all these charrettes and you need an ARP and you need an ARP and you need an ARP and I'm going to motion this ARP. Like that needs to stop. Like, and I get everybody wants it and I know everyone's asking for it. And I actually am sympathetic. I have so much sympathy for so many of these communities, but we need to do one. Like, let's show you what we can do collaboratively when we work on one, so everyone can be like, I get it. The city put in the money. The developers did X. This is what happens. This is what vibrancy could look like. And then we have a case. And right now I just feel like, you know, we've had $30 million sitting for the last budget cycle. We couldn't get it out the door. Lots of talks, lots of charrettes, lots of engagement, lots of, oh, maybe we promised that, but actually, no, we didn't promise that. We were just wanting to see what you wanted. Yeah. And then we'll get back to you. And so that's the type of stuff that needs to stop because it ends up exhausting, you know, our communities. We have burnout, we have frustration, and it actually just makes our job tougher as the industry to come in and say, well, okay, we're going to come in and do this because they're like, well, we have no certainty either because everyone keeps promising things and we don't know what we're getting.
Well, sure. I have no hesitation in recommending MARTA Loop for that project.
If neither do, neither do I.
Yeah, but to your point, Bob, in all seriousness, like you have to establish some investment criteria, and it would seem pretty obvious that a place like MARTA Loop, like not all these main streets and not all these neighborhoods, are created equal in terms of their readiness for this type of investment. You know, there's some areas arguably that are going to be a bit of a chicken and egg. You need maybe the investment up front in order to induce some investment. But there are areas like yours that are so clearly achieving its, you know, or pulling its weight in terms of intensification, but it's not getting the commensurate public investment. Joel, did you want to touch on that?
Yeah, so for the main streets piece, I want to take off my developer hat and put on my community hat for a second. And Al touched on it talking about certainty. So there has been a promise of community improvements that comes along with intensification.
Yeah.
And a community like MARTA Loop has seen that intensification. And then by cutting funding to main streets, we're not bringing in the last piece to really improve the community. And so I think what that will do is it'll help to actually improve these redeveloping areas and it'll create a bit of a self-perpetuating cycle. So there's some redevelopment, there's some investment in the at grade and below grade infrastructure for the community that makes it more attractive. More people want to come there and that just like helps to keep it going. I agree with Al too that, you know, there's a very strong business case for this. It might not be as black and white as something you can, you know, just like put down in a ledger and clearly understand it. But I think it's really important and one of the key ways that we're going to continue to try to achieve our MDP targets for growth.
All right. Well, that's the boring infrastructure stuff, but I get a kick out of it. But let's talk. You touched a little bit on the policy aspect, Al, and there was a bit of back and forth of banter on Twitter today, actually, before we recorded this, about what are the best ways to actually enable better enable, like from a policy and a regulatory standpoint, to better enable the type of growth. Should we? You know, there's a lot of debate about whether the city should lead initiatives in terms of policy and zoning changes or land use changes, city-led stuff, or whether we should let the market emerge and just simply make the process of a developer-led land use and policy change easier, you know, and let the market sort of sort out exactly what needs to occur in different locations throughout the city. And then how that matches with community expectations is a tough question to answer. This is one of the challenges of redevelopment is you're not in a blank slate environment. There's a lot of stakeholders. There's a lot of vested interests. There's a lot of people who are very attached to their community. There's some inherent, you know, resistance to change that's sort of part of our natural human nature. So how do we create a policy environment and a regulatory environment that will help achieve the goals of our MDP?
Yeah. Okay. This is a big tough nut to crack.
we'll give you an hour.
And you're going to do it, Peter. You're going to go back up to your office and say, we're doing this.
Yeah. So I think there's that, and you're right. There's this, you know, real concern of certainty. Yeah. And I think communities, you know, a lot of times feel cheated if there's a policy process that goes and then a year later, a developer comes in and says, oh, I want to change this.
Yeah.
I think it's important to be clear about, like, you know, what kind of things can we be certain about?
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's the small scale stuff. Maybe it's the row houses and townhouses. We can say those are going to go in these areas, and maybe some of the mid-rise stuff. But there's always going to be a little bit of places where no one really knows for sure where the market's going to go or how a certain site can be developed. You know, larger sites, like when we see malls redevelop or strip malls, you never really know exactly what that's going to look like. You can get a basic idea of, okay, maybe it's going to be mid-rises or maybe it's going to be, you know, high-rises.
But that's about it.
But that's about it. Yeah. And so I think it's important to be clear with, you know, engagement and communities to say, you know, what is more certain? And what is the kind of stuff that we're just going to leave this very high level for now, and we will talk about it more in more detail later. But it is a real struggle to say, you know, here's our policy, and then we're going to change it 2 years later. And I think, you know, cities and communities and developers all have to be very cautious about how much they're moving that, because you can lose trust, and that's something you don't want to do.
And I think Peter nailed it on the head. I think there is certainty that can exist within certain frameworks. And I think when we get less certain or more vague, that leaves the opportunity for innovation, for growth that we've never seen before, for better urban realms. It allows people to come to the table and justify for their ask. And I think the biggest problem that we're having is administration being confident enough to go out and say, hey guys, like, this is what we're doing. I know you might not be happy because the stakeholders are obviously in some way the people they represent. And so it's quite difficult to go in and have a conversation about, you know, we're not going to provide that level of certainty and prescription that you ask. And the harm in doing that, and I think I mentioned this to Councillor Farrell just today, is like, if all of us were to sit here and pick our absolute favorite Main Streets project, what would that be? Did it require a land use amendment? Did it not? Like, what is the best example that we have on our main streets of a development that we can all sit here and say, yep, that was good. I love that one. I would say I have more examples of ones that I hate that fit policy, that fit within the framework, and that carved into that box. And by putting them into that box from a pure development model, they're like, well, yeah, no, this is going to be stucco. It's going to be, you know, white siding. It's going to be your favorite building that you drive by every day because, you know, we just couldn't afford to put anything extra or special because the height and the number of people living in this building was weighted to be too impactful in order for us to actually have the building that we wanted. And I think to me that we need to make business cases, and we also, you know, and I will advocate for this. Like, I want urban design involved. I want the review panel. I like the changes they've made. I want them involved in our main street. I want them to help craft better buildings. And I want developers to have to actually step up. If you want more, tell us why you want more. What's the inherent benefit of more? And it can't simply be that, oh, okay, this is a tax base increase. Well, I don't buy that as a community member. I want to see great places that help actually create more interactions of people.
Yeah, it's just every developer I've ever met both wants certainty and flexibility.
Yeah.
And communities certainly err more on the certainty side. Bob, like how do you square that circle in terms of creating policy that gives certainty where it really matters, but doesn't prescribe so much that you stifle any sort of innovation or compromise and collaboration as a community? How do you actually craft policy and process and working with a community to achieve that? It just seems so fundamental to achieving these sort of things. Like when we're having, 6-hour public hearings on sixplexes, it's going to be really hard to achieve our goals, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. There's no real good answer. No real easy answer. Let's put it that way. I think it's a lot of dialogue. I think it's having some trust, including trust in the frameworks and mechanisms in which these decisions are made. Being able to communicate the benefits is also important. There's no magic bullet. One thing I know we used to talk about was with these area redevelopment plans, and people are very attached sometimes to their area redevelopment plans, and you leave something on the shelf and don't touch it for 30 years, it's going to become meaningless. And I guess what I'm saying is I think the plans are less important than the discussion.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's dialogue and framework that can evolve.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. And I think it's important also for community associations, for example, to keep on this and have a clutch of people who are good interlocutors with the industry.
Yeah.
And with the neighbors, and can work productively.
Yeah. And I think that's the way, like a lot of the discussion about NIMBY versus YIMBY, no in my backyard, yes, or, the tendency is, for the most active voices often to be the no voices, because I think the best way to enable productive dialogue is to just build that continuous relationship of trust. And I think you'll get more of those types of voices that are more productive in the conversation. And you'll end up getting better outcomes in community conversations.
I think sometimes when you get the no, I think it's sometimes you're touching people who have never been touched before by the dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that ongoing dialogue is important and communities are important.
Joel, we'll give you the last word.
Yeah, and so I think going back, trying to tie some of that all together and how we look at ARPs and the certainty behind that and how they're held so sacred. I think I do want to say that the city is currently doing some really good work on area planning and trying to tie that all together, because I think we can probably all agree that taking these little tiny areas and putting really prescriptive plans in them, that's not the way the city organically grows. So planning for larger growth areas is smarter. And rather than going and doing really prescriptive land uses in certain areas, tying back to what Peter said, saying this is probably a good idea for mid-rise, this is probably a good area for high-rise, this is a good location for ground-oriented density. And then as the projects come in, let those land uses be set by the applicants. And I think we just need a little bit more of that higher level growth planning, again, which Jordan Furness, the city is currently going through right now.
Yeah.
And that'll start to help the flow of projects into our established areas.
And just tying it all together too, that scale of planning seems more conducive to thinking about the infrastructure problems.
Absolutely.
At that scale too. So anyways, gents, it's been, we're well over past an hour now, so we'll have to reconvene the round table or the square table at another time, and we'll tackle the like dozens of other issues that affect the city building in Calgary. So thanks very much for joining us, and until next time.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Common Ground YYC is a production of Livewire Calgary. If you value quality local journalism, please just consider supporting Livewire by following them on social media, by clicking and reading stories, advertising, or contributing directly via Patreon. Visit livewirecalgary.com.